Next case on our calendar is 09441, City of Cleveland versus Washington Mutual Bank. Ms. Lynn, welcome back.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning again, and may it please the Court. With respect to the Washington Mutual cases, Your Honor, the City argues that the 8th District erred when first it made the determination that 2941.47 doesn't apply to cases in municipal court filed by complaint, and that by virtue of making that initial finding, their subsequent analysis with respect to 2938.12 and Criminal Rule 43 was in error because it refused to consider the application of that statute.
Counsel, excuse me, we have again a problem with the microphone. Can either we move the mic up or move the podium up, or so Counsel, we can hear you. Okay, now let's try that.
I did drop off a little, Your Honor, after the first argument, so I will raise my voice again. With respect to this case, the city's argument, in essence, is that the appellate court erred with respect to 2941.47 when it made the initial finding that it did not apply to cases in muni court, and then its subsequent analysis with respect to the other two statutes, 2938.12 and Criminal Rule 43, was an error because they failed to consider the application of 2941.47 to them. With respect to their refusal to apply 2941.47 to the muni court situation, the court basically looked at the plain language of the statute, and they're correct in saying that that statute does not use the word complaint in its plain language. However, as this court knows, courts are to look at statutes in parium materia, and in this case, there is another statute, 2941.35, which specifically indicates that with respect to an indictment and information, the service requirements and other requirements that apply to an indictment or information also apply to an affidavit that's filed in courts that have original jurisdiction in misdemeanors. So from that perspective, by failing to look at that statute, the city believes that the court erred when it determined that 2941.47 did not apply to this case. There are numerous cases, and we cited to some in the brief, from districts all over the state where they have used 2941.35 to analyze cases in muni court with respect to the process of an indictment, the service of indictment, and other issues. And so for that reason, we believe, although it has not actually been litigated, that 2941.47 does fall into the same sort of rubric in the sense that it should be considered the same way as these other statutes, and it should be applicable to the muni court. I'd like to fall back a little bit to the amicus curiae brief in this case, and they did notice, they did indicate in their brief, and I think this was accurate, that with respect to 2941.47, when it was enacted at that time, the only cases that corporations could be indicted for or convicted for were misdemeanors. So clearly the statute had in its intention to deal with corporate defendants who were charged with misdemeanor complaints.
But you can indict misdemeanors as opposed by affidavit, and the statute does say indict, and the statute also says clerk of the common pleas court, which seems a little out of place if they really meant misdemeanors, in the municipal or housing court. What is your response to that, that the statute really looks like these, if you're going to have a guilty finding in absentia, that it must be done in common pleas court?
Your Honor, I think that, some of the other statutes in question, they make no mention of complaints. And at the top of my head, I'm thinking 2941.30. I don't remember the exact text of it, but it just specifically states indictment and information. And then with respect to the service of an indictment or information, there are a number of other statutes in Chapter 2941 where the word complaint does not appear. But courts have found that they do apply to cases in municipal court where the filing instrument was a complaint. And for that reason, I think that you don't just look at the plain language. You do look at the plain language of the statute, obviously, but in this case, you also have to consider the language of 2941.35, which does indicate specifically.
Well, but that says laws as to form, sufficiency, amendments, objections, exceptions to indictment, and the service. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that you can replace the clerk of the common pleas court with some other clerk. I think your argument might be a stronger argument if the clerk of the common pleas court wasn't also in the statute, or if it said like clerk of courts or clerk of the court or something, but it specifically says clerk of the common pleas court.
Your Honor, I would submit, firstly, 2941.35 does say service, and 2941.47, the beginning part of that statute is specifically about the service of an indictment or an information to a corporation. And by that language, I believe that 2941.35 applies that to the muni court situation. Because of the statutory construction language, in addition to that, I think that the entire statute then must apply because clearly the intention of the legislature when they enact a statute is for the entire statute to apply. If you can find that 2941.35, as far as the service requirements, applies to muni court, then it follows that the remainder of the statute is intended to apply as well. At least that's the argument that we've made in our briefing I would make here.
Got your argument, and you're sticking with it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, the Attorney General makes a policy argument in these cases that there's a need for these statutes because of the foreclosure and the absentee problems. You appear to be asking us to write words into a statute that they've created to expand the statute, and our court has been very reluctant to do that. Isn't your argument better addressed to the General Assembly to clarify that and to clearly add the municipal level and the municipal clerk of courts?
I think, Your Honor, I would disagree in terms of that being the better argument. I think that statutorily, I think that the language is there. I think that the argument can be made that 2941.35, 2941.47 together do allow for that. And then if you add in 2901.04b, which talks about procedural statutes, I think that there is a basis to argue that in the instance of justice, in the instance of, the procedural court, that this interpretation is not overbroad. With respect to that argument, the city obviously is arguing that the lower court made a too narrow definition of these statutes and not considering 2941.47. They then went on to indicate that 2938.12 and Criminal Rule 43 were dispositive. Starting with Criminal Rule 43, to the extent that Criminal Rule 43 is being argued to create a substantive right, and the city does not believe that it's clear that there is a substantive right for a corporation to be present at trial. Criminal 43 is inapplicable. With respect to a corporation, 2941.47 clearly indicates that a corporation does not have a right to be present at the arraignment stage of the proceedings. It clearly indicates that if a corporation has been duly served and they fail to appear, the clerk of courts is able at that time to enter a plea of not guilty on behalf of the corporation. And by that language, the legislature is signaling an intent to not, first of all, to treat a corporation differently than they would treat an individual, and also to not treat a corporation as if it has that same right to be present. So to the extent that Criminal Rule 43 is being argued to require the presence of the defendant, we would argue that that is inapplicable pursuant to Article 4, Section 5B of the Ohio Constitution, which limits rules to the procedure as opposed to the creation or expansion of substantive rights. With respect to 2938.12, first, just by its plain language, it clearly appears not to be applicable to this case. It talks about a defendant absconding after the start of trial and that being a basis for a failure to appear and also for an affirmative waiver before the court. Again, those particular protections, they are based in the Constitution. They're also based in a personal right of an individual as opposed to a corporate entity. The idea being that an individual should be before the court and make the choice in open court that they are not going to be present and make that affirmative waiver before the judge. A corporation, on the other hand, never is required to be present. They can always be present by an attorney, by the presence of an attorney, and that waiver, that affirmative waiver is not designed to protect the corporation because they are never required to be there. For that reason,
counsel, could you again remind us what is the authority to say that a corporation is not required to be present at trial?
I think it's two-part, Your Honor. The amicus did argue that 2941.47 on its face
talks about the initial appearance, but not the trial.
The argument was made, though, that it does authorize a trial in absentia. From the city's perspective, we believe the better argument in that case is that 2941.47 starts the ball rolling with respect to the defendant's failure to appear and the course of action with respect to that. Subsequently, I do believe that they can waive their right to be present, that they do not have to actually show up and abscond, as is stated in 2938.12 and Criminal Rule 43. Once they have been properly brought before the jurisdiction of the court under 2941.47, if they receive notice of a hearing and they have an opportunity to appear and be heard and they make the distinction or the choice not to appear, they can waive any right that they have to appear by that action.
So you're saying that if you have proof that a corporation has been served and they do not appear, that that's evidence of waiver?
Yes, Your Honor. And I struggle with that a little bit because the argument, I could make the argument that 2941.47 just automatically blanket authorizes the trial in absentia. But the reality of the situation is it is a criminal statute. There is, as you noted earlier, a strict construction as well as the procedural issues that need to be considered. But when it comes to do you then at that point treat a corporation the same way you would treat an individual when it comes to whether or not they've waived a right, I think the Supreme Court, the federal courts that have looked at it, have indicated that you cannot treat a corporation the same at all purposes. And in this instance, I think applying 2938.12 to a corporation would be a manifest injustice to the state.
So you're saying that a criminal defendant, if it's a corporation, the waiver can be established by mere failure to show?
Failure to show
notice.
If there's notice, notice of the consequences, and that's why I think the judge's entry is important. He does send out an entry that indicates, A, you have a trial set for this date, and if you fail to appear, this is what will happen. We will have a trial in your absence.
Which is very different from waiver for an individual defendant. Our case law is very clear that you cannot presume waiver. I mean, you need affirmative showing that there's an intelligent and voluntary waiver of a right.
And I believe the standard needs to be different, Your Honor, because when it comes to an individual can, you know, leave. The reality of the situation is you may have service of a defendant on a case. They have a right to be present constitutionally. And if they fail to appear, the courts do have methods of trying to secure that appearance. They can issue an arrest warrant. The prosecutor's office, if they're aware of it, can have their police officers, investigators, or whomever try and find the defendant, secure their presence.
But for a corporation, can't you do that through the representatives of the corporation? An officer, let's say, a representative, issue a summons, have an individual appear for the corporation and waive in writing?
We could have that. I see I almost have 2 minutes, so I'm going to answer it, and then that's it. With respect to the having a summons of that person, in order to go after a corporate officer, we need to be able to show that they had some kind of authority to cause the crime for which we're charging them. And we could potentially summons the person, but we would not necessarily be able to charge them unless we have evidence that they have direct control or are responsible. And this is 29, I'm blanking on the statute right now, but the organizational responsibility statute. And with respect to that, it's very difficult to find that one person who has the authority to pretty much allow a property to fail.
Well, counsel,
in that way.
Is there ever a risk of loss of liberty in one of these proceedings against a corporation?
No, Your Honor.
So even if they found the corporate officer, say it was a corporation of two people, mm-hmm. and they found the corporate entity who is responsible for the condition of the property, and that individual does not cooperate.
If that person is charged individually?
No, the corporation is charged.
No. There's a possibility that the person could be held in contempt of court, which could lead to a potential jail firm, but because they're an individual, they would have that right to be present in those factors. So I believe
in the contempt proceedings, originally in the absentia trial. Correct? Is that's what you're saying?
Not exactly, Your Honor. I think what I'm more arguing is that if we were to summon the individual to the in absentia proceeding and they failed to appear, we could have
them. My question is, when you only cite or give notice to the charges against the corporation, and there is sufficient evidence of notice and the receipt of that notice, and there's a failure to appear, and then they go through the absentia proceedings, there is never the potential for a loss of liberty to the corporate officers or?
I would say no, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank
counsel,
you.
Before you sit down, I have one other question. And that deals, there, and it's been raised in the briefs, that there's a question whether or not there was service, actual service, on the corporation in this case. And putting aside the point whether there was or was not, if the if a representative of the corporation is not required to come into court, how will the court ever know if, I mean, obviously, there's some cases where it's pretty clear there's service, but in the case where you maybe have different names and, you know, it's just not real certain, how will the court ever know if it ever got service on the individual? If there's nobody there to come and, you know, show up, and so you obviously you know they did. Is there a mechanism for correcting that after conviction?
There's not a method for correcting it after conviction, but the reality is in the forefront, most corporations that own property in the state are required to be registered with the Secretary of State's office. So we do, and the court does send notice to the statutory agent. Often what happens sometimes is, you know, the statutory agent is no longer good. You know, they've changed statutory agents, but they haven't updated their records. We send it to the tax mailing address. I think the city does its due diligence to try and make sure that the notice gets to the right people and that the court has that information. If the defendant has not created a record, a good record as to who should receive notice, I think the city is, you know, we have done our duty when we sent it to the addresses that are of public record. And if we have to search further in order to find the person because of their lack of good record keeping, that is a chance they take with respect to a judgment in this kind.
We don't have that problem with an individual then, because they actually, you have to actually find them and they have to come into court.
Correct.
And so there's another sort of loose end, I guess, in terms of liability of corporations for criminal conduct when in absentia. Just a final question. I see this case was decided after the Destiny Ventures case in the appellate district, and they're obviously different results. Was there a request for the 8th District to hear this en banc?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I think that the motion to reconsider did not request it, though it was raised at a brief level, and I think it was the first assignment. It was at one point raised that it was mandatory based on the McFadden case, and that was the only way it was raised. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Lynn. Mr. Bailo.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice and Associate Justices, may it please the Court. I'm Vladimir Bailo, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the appellee. Washington Mutual Bank, the appellee, was convicted in this case of a criminal housing code violation and fined $100,000 after a bench trial at which it was not present either through its corporate representative or either through a corporate representative or through its counsel. Now, even putting aside a substantial factual dispute in this case, and you, Justice Cupp, touched on it for a moment at the end of Ms. Lynn's argument, putting aside the factual dispute as to whether service was actually perfected upon Washington Mutual Bank in this case, the Court of Appeals was absolutely correct. There is no statutory authority under Ohio law for the municipal court to have convened a trial in absentia in this case. Now, the City of Cleveland is asking this court to find that 2941.47 of the Ohio Revised Code grants it that authority for misdemeanor prosecutions in the municipal court. Well, it doesn't. The statute invoked by the city doesn't say that it applies to municipal court prosecutions. It says it applies to prosecutions commenced by indictment or information. Well, what are prosecutions commenced by indictment of information? Those are prosecutions in the Court of Common Pleas.
Our Rule 7A, as you know, the Attorney General in its brief argues that Criminal Rule 7A says that a misdemeanor may be prosecuted by indictment or information.
Yes, it can. A misdemeanor may be prosecuted by indictment or information in the Court of Common Pleas. Because when you have a grand jury that issues an indictment, a grand jury issues an indictment in the Court of Common Pleas. When you have an information, statutorily, an information is a document prepared by the county prosecutor in the Court of Common Pleas. So those are methods of prosecution that are unique to the Court of Common Pleas, both indictment and information. So it is our position that by its terms, 2941.47 applies squarely and only to prosecutions in the Court of Common Pleas. And most importantly, Your Honors, in this case, regardless of the charging instrument, the method a prosecution is commenced, the statute the city invokes does not say that any corporation may be tried in absentia if it does not respond to a criminal summons. By taking that position, the city of Cleveland is asking this court to engraft language on a statute that simply is not there. Now, before I delve into the statutory interpretation type issues, I want to address a couple of questions from the justices that came up at the very end, at the tail end of Ms. Lynn's argument. Justice O'Connor, you asked a question about the liberty. Is there any risk that any liberty is going to be trampled upon by the conviction in this case? I would have been inclined to say the same thing as Ms. Lynn before I looked at the record in this case. And when the court looks at the record in this case, you'll find that after the judgment entry of conviction, there is actually a commitment paper where the Judge Pianca has ordered Washington Mutual Service Corporation, now misnamed the corporation, but has ordered essentially the corporation to appear at the workhouse in Cleveland. I was stunned to find that myself and not really sure what that actually means. So as far as your question is there any chance of any liberty being at risk here, I think the answer is we don't know, because the city at the very least has shown a willingness to actually get a corporation to have someone report to a workhouse
was
by
that,
some date
was
certain.
Was that just a blanket form sent out, not specifically directed towards your client?
It is a blanket form. You can tell it's a form document, but the name is typed in Washington Mutual Corporation Service. Now, it's the wrong name. It doesn't name Washington Mutual Bank correctly, but it has the case number. It is clearly a document that is intended to be filed in this case. And so when you look at the record, there is at least an ambiguity as to what the court intended to do pursuant to the conviction here. So there was a fine of $100,000, and then we have this commitment paper.
Who or what appeared at the workhouse? Was there a stay put on?
It is not my understanding that there was a stay. There was a timely notice of appeal filed when someone finally, by mere coincidence, happened to find that there was this conviction. But as far as to my knowledge, there has not been a stay, and no one reported to the commitment house, and no further action was taken at that point. And responding to another question, Justice Cupp, you brought up the concern about whether there is any what happens when a corporation has been issued a summons and no one shows up. How is a court to know that service was actually effectuated? Well, I think the answer to that is you just don't know. Now, in this case, when the court views the record, you will find that there actually is a return card from the certified mail of the summons, and it is signed by a gentleman named Dean Kessler as purportedly the statutory agent. Now, he is the statutory agent, however, of an entity that was referred to in the complaint as Washington Mutual Care of CSC Lawyers Corporation Service. Well, that is the statutory agent for an entity called Washington Mutual Finance Company, which incidentally is a dead corporation that was merged out of existence in 2004, 3 years before the complaint in this case was filed. Now, I will represent to this court that at the time of this prosecution was commenced, Washington Mutual Bank did not have a statutory agent within the state of Ohio. Washington Mutual Bank did not have any banking operations in the state of Ohio. Now, this court might recall that it had a case last summer, Washington Mutual versus Beatley, that had this issue within it. So there is some institutional knowledge of that fact that Washington Mutual did not have a statutory agent in Ohio during the relevant period of time. The long and the short of it, Justice Cupp and Justices of the Court, is that Washington Mutual Bank was never served with a criminal summons in this case. So this case illustrates the problem with an interpretation of 2941.47 that would allow a trial in absentia when you have service defects such as that which took place
counsel,
here.
Counsel, if we were in the, just out of curiosity, in the Common Pleas Court, it still has the same notice requirements, correct?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
So that mistake could have been made had this been processed through the Common Pleas Court as well.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
So there's a flaw in the statute, not necessarily in the way the city is proceeding with this statute.
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor, because I would take it is Washington Mutual's position that 2941.47 in the Common Pleas Court does not grant the Common Pleas Court the authority to convene a trial in absentia. At most, what the statute does is it allows the clerk of the Common Pleas Court to enter a plea of not guilty on behalf of the corporation. It does not take the extra step of allowing the Common Pleas Court to go ahead with a trial in the defendant's absence. And this is where the 8th District Court of Appeals opinion was absolutely correct. It found that...
Which time? The first time or the second time?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I'll address the in-bank issue here. This time it was correct. Now, what it found here was that as a matter of statutory interpretation, Section 2941.47 of the Ohio Revised Code applied only to prosecutions commenced by indictment or information, essentially Common Pleas Court prosecutions. So absent that authority to try in absentia under 2941.47, the court needed to look elsewhere to find if there was any authority for trying a criminal defendant, whether it be corporation or individual, in absentia. That is why the court properly looked to 2938.12, which specifically deals with prosecutions in municipal courts, and Criminal Rule 43, which deals specifically with prosecutions, period. And so that's where the 8th District Court of Appeals very correctly found that there was no authority for convening the trial in absentia in this case. Now, as to the in-bank issue, Your Honor, it is my understanding that there was no request for in-bank consideration, and there is a reasonable and rational reason for that. It's because the two cases are different. The Destiny Ventures case did not have the statutory interpretation piece before it. If you look at the Destiny Ventures Court of Appeals opinion and the assignments of error that were before the court there was an assignment of error as to the court's treatment of what was styled as a Rule 60B motion. There was an assignment of error that dealt with the Confrontation Clause issue, which this court entertained this morning in the Destiny Ventures appeal. And then there was a sentencing assignment of error. So really, the statutory interpretation piece was not before the court in Destiny Ventures. And in fact, in the judgment entry in which the 8th District Court of Appeals denied the city's motion for reconsideration in this case, the Court of Appeals recognized that and identified that. It said in its reconsideration entry that Destiny Ventures, the posture before it was an assumption without a decision that 2941.47 allowed a trial in absentia in the municipal court. So that's the difference. That's why, not to really get in the minds of the counsel below, but I believe that's the reason there was no in-bank consideration. And frankly, because of the differing legal issues that were at play in this case compared with Destiny Ventures, there was really no basis for there to be an in-bank consideration because there was no actual conflict between panels on an issue of law.
Mr. Bellow, on the two statutes, or the statute and the rule that you referred to, 2938.12 and Criminal Rule 43, are you saying those are the only ways that a corporation could have a trial in absentia?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. In fact, not just corporations. I'm saying that that's the only way any defendant
right.
For a misdemeanor in municipal court may be tried in absentia.
And as you heard, as we've been listening to these particular cases, which can be very troublesome when you have a corporation as a defendant, policy-wise, your position would suggest that a corporation can escape prosecution, basically, in the misdemeanor courts by just not appearing at all.
I don't know about escape prosecution, Your Honor. It's the same conundrum you might have when prosecuting an individual by complaint and summons. Just as a corporation may be prosecuted by complaint or summons in a municipal court for a municipal ordinance criminal violation, there doesn't need to be an arrest or a warrant or anything of that nature. Any type of prosecution like that may be commenced by complaint and summons. And I believe statutorily, under the chapter dealing with municipal court prosecutions, what happens when a criminal defendant does not appear pursuant to a criminal summons is that a court may issue a show cause order and hold the defendant in contempt. And so a contempt order may issue, and a contempt fine may issue.
Or bench warrant could be issued against a defendant who doesn't appear, so that if that individual's picked up on a traffic-related matter, for example, eventually that individual will appear in front of the judge.
Yes, that for an individual, you have that warrant for arrest hammer, if you will.
Which is not available for a corporate defendant.
Correct. That is not available for a corporate defendant. What you have for a corporate defendant is potentially the only hammer is the one for contempt. But as Justice Stratton, you referred to it earlier during Ms. Lynn's argument, that this seems to be, if there's any gap there, that is one for the legislature to solve. It's not for the judiciary to solve by engrafting language onto a statute. And incidentally, I'd like to point out that, and you had asked, I believe, in the Destiny Ventures argument, Justice O'Donnell, what's going on now? Are they still convening these trials in absentia? Well, they're not. In fact, what they're doing, as far as I understand it, is the housing court has a corporation in absentia docket. And when a corporation does not appear in response to a summons, what the judge will do at that point, the way I understand it, is set it for a show cause hearing. And if the corporation does not appear at that, either through counsel or through a corporate representative, then you have some contempt proceedings. And so to the extent this court is worried that there are no other mechanisms by which to bring the corporation to justice, if you will, there are. There are the contempt mechanisms. There are civil remedies perhaps available if the city of Cleveland wants to commence civil nuisance proceedings against corporations. But criminally, there is no statutory basis for allowing trials in absentia.
And so, Mr. Bellow, just to explore one particular issue, are you saying that, in your view, the corporate defendant has coterminous rights with an individual defendant in a criminal case?
In a criminal case, as far as the issue of when a trial in absentia is proper, those rights are coterminous because there is nothing statutorily or constitutionally or in the case law that differentiates between the two that way. Now, Ms. Lynn, in response to some questions, has indicated and made some references to cases that say that corporations don't have the same extent of constitutional rights as an individual does. Well, if you really hammer down through it and peel it away, really the only one example you can really find in the case law is the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. There is a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. There is a due process right to be present. And so as far as those rights go, the corporation's rights are the same as an individual. Now, and briefly, as my time has run out, actually, and so for the reasons stated in the brief and stated here today, I respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of the 8th District Court of Appeals. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bellow. Ms. Lynn, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Your Honor, I just want to hit up on three points with respect to this. First, the distinction between whether or not 2941-47 should apply in municipal court or common pleas court only. There is no logical reason to draw a line between which court can hear these cases. In this situation, pretty much you're basically looking at a corporation who's charged with a criminal complaint. There's no reason why a misdemeanor that is filed by a complaint should be less worthy of this kind of treatment than a misdemeanor that's filed by an indictment or information. With respect to the contempt issue, contempt doesn't resolve the criminal litigation issue. The reality is that the judge can't hold the corporation in contempt and has in fact done so, but the reality is that still leaves the criminal citation out there. It's unresolved. There is no finding of guilt. There's no way to resolve that case until we get the corporation in here. The contempt is the court's way of responding to the fact that the corporation has noticed and has failed to appear, and he's penalizing those defendants for that failure. He's not addressing the city's criminal complaint. And finally, the last thing I would say is that the city should not have to be limited to just civil remedies. We should be able to exercise our right to sue civilly if that's the best way to achieve a result. We should also be able to punish if that's the way that we choose to exercise our authority in these situations. Civil remedies are available, but we also have the criminal jurisdiction. We should be allowed to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Ms. Lynn. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.